Okay. Two things. One is that I had so many people asking for the Genesis and Revelation contrast that I included at the top of today's handout. Because one of the things we've been talking about is different forms in the Bible, different poetic forms and structures and whatnot. And one of the things that comes out is that Genesis and Revelation, within their first and last few chapters, have some similar, in many cases, contrasting statements. For example, there's heavens and earth created in Genesis 1:1. And a new heaven and new earth in Revelation 21:1, and et cetera. So, at any rate, you can take a look at that. I included also the summary of the divided kingdom. And one of the reasons I included it is I misspoke. I said there were 20 kings in the northern kingdom. Nancy was checking me. And I need to correct that. It's 19, just like we had in the chart. But it doesn't matter. They were all bad. They were all bad, you know. So, at any rate, so we'll need to make note of that. So 19 kings in the northern kingdom, not 20, and just the same. They were all bad. About 9 dynasties, and each dynasty would end with a murder, and they start a new dynasty. So, evil in the conduct of their kingship, and also evil in the ending of many of those kingships. Okay, so now, one of the things I thought about is we have a 6-month-long elective on Bible backgrounds, in which we cover Bible cultures, right? And we cover it in several stages. And that's all fine and well, and what we were looking at doing is trying to condense that. So you sort of, but that's a bit much. It would be... see those 5 books that are stacked there? That would be like trying to cover all of that today. Right? So we thought, probably shouldn't do that, right? Probably shouldn't do that. And so what we'll focus on instead is looking at what are some resources that are available for you to be able to look things up about Old Testament history and culture. Okay? Those two things. Most people... can fairly easily think of, okay, here's some resources for Old Testament history, but the cultural aspects are sometimes huge, and they can be a little tougher to find. So I want to offer that to you. So one of them is a great website, BibleHistory.com, no charge, and I found the fellow who runs it is happy to have you. You know, print things off, copy them, distribute them. He's fine with all that. But he's pulled together some really good, you know, resources for looking things up. Maps and charts and, you know, little article write-ups and things like that. So highly recommendable. He's a good guy. Seems conscientious and careful. But freely, makes everything available. So anyway, that's one I can recommend. One that is somewhat dated, but still very recommendable, Alfred Edersheim. Sometimes it's pronounced Edersheim. Shouldn't be. Edersheim. It's Edersholm, essentially, what it means in the German. And so here's Bible study tools. Now, one of the things I've done here where we've got some big, long website address, I've changed it to a tiny URL address. So I put that on there. So that you can get it more easily. The other thing that I'll do is I will post the PowerPoint slide set so you can just copy off of that if you want to even do it more easily.
I assume that's in English.
Yes.
In
yes. It's very well done. He's done a lot of studies. And several different volumes. And by now they're in the public domain. So you can buy them printed, but you don't need to. So those are recommendable, and he's done a lot of careful study. The only drawback is more recent discoveries are not included. Okay? So it's somewhat dated. Bible timeline resources. I don't know about you, but it helps for me to kind of get, okay, here's the timeline, and here's where this is happening. For example, if I had some piece of information about the Apostle Paul, is that going to fit into the time of Abraham? Not so much, right? Wrong time by many, many centuries. So I need to find out, okay, is the cultural information I have, the historical information that I have, am I matching things up to the text? Right? So I'm studying through Genesis, something about the Apostle Paul isn't going to fit, and maybe even something about, you know, David isn't going to fit. Right? Moses compiled Genesis, as I've been talking with Megan about. Moses compiled Genesis, but even he was writing about a time, about times that were centuries before his time. Right? Okay, so looking at that, one place I have a BibleHistory.com, and I have a tiny URL about that. With the advantage of the tiny URL is you just, after, you know, putting in tinyurl.com, there's only, you know, usually about 7 or 8 letters or numbers sometimes. And you can get that on there. So there's an online free Bible timeline. Okay. In addition, okay, here's an example, and feel free to take a look at it afterwards. This timeline here covers the whole front pew. Okay. And this is available from Rose. We keep a copy of it in the church library. If you would like to, you know, check that out and take a look at it. There you've got quite a bit of detail, right, as opposed to some of the things that are available.
Vern?
Yeah.
When they have, you know, like the first patriarchs, from Adam to Lamech or Noah, would they have the their lifespans in lines to see, so we can see the overlap of the...
Yeah, the answer is yes, and we have that in our, I'll talk about this in a minute, in our Bible backgrounds material, and you can download that online. It's also in our Genesis study that we did in the main service, you know, some years back. And so it's available both ways there. So it's online. You can also ask for copies of it from Sue or Nancy as well. They'll pull it out of the file. So several different ways you can get access to it. And two ways. One is we'll have a vertical bar chart. And then we'll have a horizontal bar chart where the lifetimes are, you know, staged. You know, one, then the next one, then the next. So a couple of different formats even. But that's a good question. I think there's a lot to be learned from it. We're going to be kind of taking a look at that briefly here. Then we also have the Bible Hub, which is more of a columnar, you know, in a column type listing, from going from, you know, oldest to youngest, etc. And then we have one more, and then it shows I show it in a tiny URL. That's one page, Old Testament, New. And now take a look at the last page in your handout, and there's another, it includes both Old Testament and New Testament timeline on one page. So you have that where it's very convenient, one page, and then you have something as much as, you know, what you see on the front pew here, where lots and lots and lots of detail, right? And there's advantages to both. It's nice to have something convenient. I mean, this is almost the kind of thing you could carry around your Bible and, you know, use it fairly regularly. And it's fairly well done, I think. I've looked at the dates, and I think, with rare exception, I would say the dates are pretty spot on. So, so those are some good resources for timelines. Just kind of looking, okay, here's the context time-wise. Here's what was happening at that time. Okay? And so you're matching up, you know, where things fit. Right? Now let's take a look at another one, Bible atlases. Good Bible atlases, and frankly there are a lot of them, more than I could list here. But some of the Bible atlases, the InterVarsity Press Atlas of Bible History is a good one. Here's one that I show a link to and then a tiny URL. 190 pages of free maps, and they're very good. Color maps, 197 pages of maps are free. They're in color, and you can, you know, download and store them electronically, you know, pull them up. I draw on those from time to time, where I like color maps to show the different areas. So, and free to use. Its origin is puzzling, but I won't go into that. Okay. The Oxford Bible Atlas is also available online, free. Okay. And that's very well done. And the Bible Atlas and Companion is another one that's out there. And there are actually a number of good Bible atlases that you can look at. And those will focus, they tend to focus more on maps. They tend to focus less on giving you a lot of cultural detail. Okay. But it's at least a resource that it's good to have. By the way, I don't recommend that you go out and just buy all of these things. A lot of them are free, and especially if you have something where you can get access online. Now, there are also oldies but goodies. Okay? And by that, I mean, here would be an example. Elishka, you know, bought a copy of this for like a dollar, right? And it was done by Reader's Digest about 40 years ago. But it's quite well done, and there's some good illustrations of things that it's hard to get, you know, pictures and things like that of. So it's very good for not so much timeline and history and map kind of things, but good cultural background illustrations. And like I say, you can get it sometimes for really cheap, and it's a good resource. I actually use it a fair amount. Okay. Another one is Views of the Biblical World, which is a similar oldie by Michael Avellona, who's a Jewish archaeologist, and taken a lot of culturally relevant pictures. So it's actually lots of color photographs that he's collected, and he goes from the Old Testament into the New. The Old Testament is four volumes of pictures, and the New Testament is one volume. That's the fifth volume. But a good resource. I actually don't have all of them, but I hope to collect them over time. Okay, let's take a look at page two. So also for historical and cultural background, the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary Set, Old Testament, in five volumes. Okay? That's this one here that I talked about earlier. It's not perfect, but it's a great resource. And here's the advantage in it. It's just like you go through the Bible and you get Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and you go through, you know, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. That's the way it's formatted. So if you're looking, for example, for something on, you know, Joshua chapter 1, you go through it in Bible sequence. And here's Joshua, and then it starts and goes through Joshua sequentially. So that's how you look things up. So if you're studying a particular book or passage, you can just open it up right to, you know, the Bible reference. You know, I give the example of Joshua chapter 1, but whatever it is, you can take a look at that. And then it'll give you historical and cultural information relevant to that particular passage. So, we've got the whole set, and that's available. Another, it's also available on Olive Tree Software, where they have the Old Testament in that format. And the New Testament as well. So you can get it all on software for both the Old and the New Testament. And I think recently they had it on sale, you know, so that that's another way to access the information if you like that. And all the free software works whether you've got, you know, Apple or the Windows environment. It works on tablets, even works on phones. So that's another option for you, depending on what you prefer. Some people like to have the paper, you know. anyway, whatever is an available format for you, one that you favor. Now, it is good material, and it's real easy to use because everything's in Bible sequence, right? And with Bible references and all that. So, and they've got, you know, good pictures where they're relevant and all that. Occasionally they stumble in both the Old Testament and the New, so it's not perfect. Personally, I like to have a cross-check. I cross-check everything several times anyway. but I like to have a cross-check because, for instance, in the Old Testament, they don't take the early chapters of Genesis seriously, in my opinion. They don't take them literally. Okay? And so that's a place where I would say caution, right? In the New Testament, there are a few places where they either could have brought something up, or in one case or two I can think of, they went the wrong route. So anyway, just with those cautions, they're both a good place to start. Right? They're both the Old and the New Testaments. All right, some other sources. Peoples of the Old Testament World is a book that it talks about the peoples and the cultures and the histories of the various ones in the Old Testament realm. And so you get, it's a book, mostly text, writing about those peoples, histories and cultures. Like, where did the Assyrians come from? How did they carry out life? And that kind of thing. And then the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary for the Old Testament. That one is briefer. Instead of having this, five volumes, that's all in one volume. And it's pretty good. I do not recommend the New Testament version. I don't want anybody to hurt themselves. Okay? So, the Old Testament version, I think, is good. You also have books that are available, and again, I'm not recommending anybody just go out and start buying a bunch of books. There's individual books on cultures that are available, and these days they're available sometimes on Kindle or PDF files. I have a lot of them in PDF or Adobe Acrobat files. Jonathan Tubb on the Canaanites, Everyday Life in Babylonian and Assyria by Sags. Okay? The Babylonian World by Lake. And Persia and the Bible by Edwin Yamauchi, who, by the way, grew up as a Buddhist, right? He's Christian now. He has been for quite a while. So anyway, there are lots of books like this available. One of the places I say to check is check with major universities that have museums and with the museums themselves. Metropolitan Museum of Art, for example, has a free Adobe Acrobat book on Egyptian art. You can just download it, right? And just about all of the universities and major museums will have things like that you can download. When I went to the British Museum, they have an Adobe Acrobat file for free. It says, here's all the Bible-related exhibits at the British Museum. Okay? So that's really cool. So they got pictures, and here's the background. So anyway, there are a lot these days, especially with a lot of the Adobe Acrobat files, lots of free resources, and some of them are very good. Okay. The other thing is we had the Bible Backgrounds elective here in 2012. And what we did is we did Bible Backgrounds for 6 months, and then we did Church History for 6 months. And so the first half of that is lots of good Bible Backgrounds information on history and culture. And that has a lot of resources, including the chart that you talked about, where you've got all these different lifespans of the early patriarchs all graphed together. It is amazing who lived contemporaneously, right, at the same time, with who. I mean, it's really astounding when you live that long. And we'll be talking about that briefly here. So at any rate, with some Bible Backgrounds, the audio is available online. Okay, it's under the archived series. And the audio is available. All the handouts are available, so you can get it there. If you want to get something on paper, talk to Nancy or Sue, and they can get you paper copies of those kind of things as well. And then another great resource is the Bible itself. And here's why I say that, and especially today with a lot of the things that are available. Tell me, how many resources do we have about what the culture was like before the flood? One. What's that one resource? It's the Bible. And that's the only place we can get information about life before the flood.
Yeah, because everything was underwater.
Everything was chewed up, right?
Yeah.
Everything was buried. Occasionally something, here's for example, there was a guy who was breaking up his coal and found an iron pot in the coal. Now, problem. Okay, you've got this iron pot that's in coal. Now, coal is supposed to be millions of years old, right? Depending upon the deposit. And in many cases, hundreds of millions of years old, right? So, now the problem, what's the problem? The guy finds this lump of coal and it's got an iron pot in it. What's the problem with that, scientifically?
Can't be more than a few thousand years old.
Well, yeah, but there's a problem with it, scientifically. And what's the problem?
Why the age was supposed to be much further down the road, and why did it be embedded in coal?
Yeah, and there's that. But there's a problem scientifically, because you need to find it in place. To have some guy where they've gone in there and they've scooped up gobs of coal, and then they sold it to this guy and got it in his house, and he doesn't know where that came from. Okay, you need to be able to find it in place and have scientists look at it and say, okay, we've got this coal and we think it's this old, and find it in place in order to have something that is scientifically verifiable. It's one of the problems in Israel, they'll have a problem in other places with antiquities that are just kind of passed along and have not been found in place. So that's why there's laws against, taking out antiquities and just, hauling them off. Because you need to find it in context. Right. Yeah.
Since we find dinosaur bones and stuff like that, when they do archaeological digs, why don't we find human remains from the flood?
Well, in fact, we do. But, yeah.
Nobody ever says anything about it.
No, you won't hear anything about it. If they can't figure it out, they just put it in the back of some, museum storage or something like that.
Because it doesn't flow with their theory of evolution.
No. No, and I've seen various fossils that are just like, this is inexplicable, it just gets backpedaled, and then data, for example, all right. So here's this dinosaur bone supposed to have died off 63 million years ago, right? So if I get a radiocarbon date on it that's more like 30,000 years ago, that's like not supposed to happen, right? But on the other hand, it happens fairly regularly. But the answer is, well, of course something's wrong, so don't test it for radiocarbon, right? Instead of investigating why we have this anomaly.
It just doesn't conform to our theory, so
yes,
it's wrong.
That's right. Right, so yeah, very interesting. That's before the flood, but there are things after the flood where the Bible is a great resource. And let me give you an example. The phrase, after these things. After these things starts in Genesis, okay, and continues on into the book of Revelation. And understanding, after these things is used in a historical context for historical sequence and historical reality. That means when I see after these things repeatedly in the book of Revelation, John is intending to write future history. In the New Testament, including the Gospel of John, he is the most frequent user of that phrase. Today, with the ability to do multiple word searches together, okay, we can find all those locations quickly. Which is why when I went looking, I didn't find any other commentary that made note of the after these things phrase, because each of those individual words doesn't get you anywhere. You have too many places where it shows up. But the ability to put those together is now a unique ability. There are ways in which our ability to study the Bible is as good as it has ever been. Okay? In our time, the ability... I mean, I can pull up here's a picture of the excavation at Ur, where Abraham grew up and where Abraham was from, right? I can pull up pictures of the excavation at Jericho, and there's the archaeologist who report on it. I can look up things, you know, culturally and time-wise, and just instantly be places that previously it'd take quite a trip to the library to possibly find those. So, we have some tremendous study ability. So what's really interesting is we have the ability to be quick and accurate to a degree that has never been possible before. But has most of Christendom tracked with that? Most of Christendom has not tracked with that, unfortunately. Okay, let's take a look. There is another handout. Okay, behind, just in front of your timeline, the top says gates. Okay? So here's something very interesting. This is just one topic where in ancient times, the word gate had huge significance in a lot of things. In our own time, I've got a couple of gates at my place, and there's no particular, vast cultural significance to them. But in biblical times, the gates to a city had some particularly significant meanings, and it's all throughout the Old Testament, and actually it goes on into the New Testament. Okay? Here's some examples. To possess the gate of a city was to possess the city entirely. Okay? You possess the gate, you got the whole thing. Okay? So then, many cities did not have a designated marketplace within the city, but instead had their marketplace around the gates. Okay? 2 Kings 7:1. So, we talk about it, okay, what store am I going to go to, right? Well, the store you're going to go to, back in Old Testament times, you're going to go to the city gates, right? That's where you're going to buy and sell stuff. The next one, the official transactions were often done at city gates. Genesis 23:3 and Ruth 4:1 and following. So you have some examples here. At Genesis 23:1, Abraham needs to buy a place to bury Sarah. And the custom is you don't just dig a hole in the ground. You either get a cave that's a natural cave or one that's carved out. And he needs one right now. Right? And so where does he go to get that? He goes to the gates. Okay, so negotiating this transaction, it's the cave of Machpelah in Hebron. And so not only is Sarah buried there, but several other patriarchs buried there. Right? And they take him back into this long cave. And the last time anyone was back there that I know of, Yigal Yadin, who's an Israeli guy who's dead now, sent in a 12-year-old girl back there because she could go back through the tight spaces. And he had the Muslim guards go away for a little bit in order that he'd be able to do that. But when he was negotiating for that cave, Abraham I'm talking about, when Abraham was negotiating for the cave, the owner of the cave says, I'll give it to you for a break. And Abraham insists, I want full price. Right? And so Abraham is haggling by faith. Okay? And according to the customs, because he says, I want full price. Why? Because the owner could then repossess it if you didn't pay full price. Okay? So he insists on full price because he doesn't want to all of a sudden have a situation where this cave is going to be somebody else's and he can't, bury it. What's he going to do? Sarah's buried here. So he wants it for a permanent possession, one that can be carried and passed along to family. Right? So how does he do that? He goes to the gates. That's the place to do it. You don't go out in the orchard and you don't go back in some restaurant, No, you go to the gates. That's where you're going to do business. Yeah?
Just a question. One of the reasons that they would do this at the gate is that there would be then witnesses, whereas, say, if you went to a restaurant or in your own home, it would just be your word against mine as to what...
One is you would have people who were confident witnesses, but that's also where the elders gathered, right? And they would be naturally considered... These are my reliable witnesses, and they not only testify but confirm that this is a reasonable transaction. It was done properly. Yeah.
And most of the cities were walled. So
yes.
So this is where it's kind of like where TSA would be. because you got all the people coming
in. This is where you're coming in and going out. Period.
Right. And so if you've got the marketplace there, you've got a lot of people looking at the gate, you've got people looking at the people coming in. Mm-hmm. So there's always observation of this particular area, right? It's kind of the center of activity, so to speak.
There's kings and royalty often addressed people of varying rank and status at the city gates. So there are several different examples of that from 2 Samuel into Jeremiah. So you have then legal cases and judgments were often brought before officials and elders at the city gates. Right, so you see that in Deuteronomy and frankly elsewhere. Judgments were commonly carried out at the city gates. If they had a prison, the prison was only to hold somebody until you could, you know, get a trial together, and it was typically right near the city gates. And sometimes it might even be just you're going to chain them, right, to the wall. And that would be it. Okay? So there is no, you know, years and years of incarceration as a punishment. We're going to decide right now what's going to happen. Yeah.
I just when I was in Turkey, they still kind of do that.
Uh-huh.
Because they had this big barbed wire fence area. The fence was probably about 20 feet high. And they just ran people in there that were temporarily imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in this fenced enclosure.
Yeah.
Temporary prison.
Yeah. And so in that culture, there is no you're incarcerated for years and decades and all that. You know, you're going to decide something. You're either going to pay this back or you're going to lose your life or whatever's going to happen, but it's going to be decided right here today. Yes?
Many of the cities had several gates. Is that correct?
Larger ones did. For example, Jerusalem. Over time, even now, has a number of different gates. And as walls move, of course, then you get, you know, different gate configurations. So larger ones did, typically a smaller place, one or at most two gates. And actually two gates is rare for a smaller place.
Did they do specific things at specific gates, like sell vegetables at one gate and make civil decisions at another gate, or was it kind of...
Well, yeah, and there were certain variations on here's the place you enter. Oftentimes, for example, at Jerusalem, the gates would point towards a particular place. Here is the Damascus Gate. Right, and that points towards Damascus, and then they'll have another place they call the Dung Gate, the southern part of Jerusalem, and that's because you would take in the animals for sacrifice there, and that's where they take out the manure. Right, so yeah, you're not taking manure out this gate. This one is the only one, right? So then. You had some larger cities had temporary prisons at the gates only to hold someone until the officials or elders could hear their case. Judgment did not include more time in the temporary prison. That just wasn't the outcome. Okay? To sit at the gates meant to be honored. So this was Job and then also in Proverbs. To enter the city gates often meant citizenship. Okay? You were a citizen if you entered these gates. Another thing is we think of citizens as citizens of a country. In ancient times, on into the time of the Roman Empire, citizenship was citizenship in a particular city. Paul, for example, was a what citizen?
Roman.
He was a Roman citizen, right? So Paul was a Roman citizen. And that gave him certain rights and privileges, which ended up impacting the outcome towards the end of the book of Acts. Right? So you have that. To lift up the heads of the gates was an expression for opening the gates and rejoicing and welcoming of someone. Conversely, gates that sank are an expression of hopelessness, despair, and defeat in the city. Right? So where we think of gates as, okay, I go to Home Depot and get some hardware and, you know, get some bolts and get some boards, and I'm going to make myself a gate. And there's no big particular attachment to it. You can see in the Old Testament, and actually it carries on into the New, gates were hugely significant, and everything pivoted around the gates. Everything pivoted around the gates. When Solomon became king, he upgraded the gates at Megiddo, right? You went and paid for upgrades of how many, they have so many chambers, you know, at the entry of the gates, and he strengthened them and increased their size. Yeah.
So there was basically always barbarians, right? So
yeah, you always had people you had to defend against.
Right, and so you got the city, that's why you got the walls, and you got all these native and other people living out in the countryside that are basically always trying to get in, or you got war to worry about, and so it's a big deal. I mean, gates are...
You would want to have... You'd actually want to minimize the number of gates, because the more gates you have, that's a potentially weak point. You'd want to strengthen the gates that you have. July 170 AD, the Romans started the battering rams at the gates of Jerusalem. Did they succeed? No. They couldn't get through the gates, and so they broke through by other means. Okay? They broke through by other means. By the middle of August, a month and a half later, they'd broken through, but it wasn't through the gates. Okay? So the gates held. They had to pick another means, and of course the Romans will ultimately, you know, keep at it until they win. But it's just an instance. A gate is usually a weak point. You want to minimize them. You want to have them as strong as you can, because you have enemies attack. So, anyway, this is just an example where the Bible itself often provides lots of cultural information. Okay, so back to our storyline here. Let's go to... I'd like us to go down to the bottom of page 3. We're going to run out of time here. We have two worldviews of cultural development... And Nancy was puzzled as she, you know, was proofreading this for me, so I want to make sure I explain it so that you aren't puzzled. Okay? In the evolutionary view of cultural development, which does not include a worldwide flood, the idea is that civilization develops gradually. And what were some of the places that civilization first developed? Pardon? Yeah, Ur, and Ur. So you got Mesopotamia. And so that includes, you know, Ur and Haran, that entire area along the Euphrates and Tigris River. So you got that area is developing. Where else?
Egypt.
You got Egypt along the northern part of the Nile River is developing as a civilization. And by the way, the Great Pyramids, those predate Abraham. Okay? They predate Abraham. They were there when Abraham came, and they were fairly new. So you have Egypt. Where else do we have civilization beginning to develop? Another location that you have is over in India and China. Okay, so you get the Asian civilizations beginning to develop. Right? So you've got kind of that spread of civilization. And so, you know, Europe and America, they were, you know, long later. So we're latecomers compared to the world's, you know, history. So you have civilization developing. The biblical view of cultural development is you have culture developing from the time of the fall, right? And who was the first one to build a city? The Bible says Cain was the first one to start building a city. Right? So you have the development of culture of different kinds, metallurgy, okay, marriage. You have the development of culture. And then the flood cuts everything off, and from there you have both those who quickly started establishing civilization and those who are migrating in cultural decline because of migration, right? You don't have big towers and city walls if you're migrating, right? Just don't bother because you could be moving on. So the migration pattern tended towards a decline of culture, whereas staying in the area around the where the ark landed and around the Tower of Babel tended to allow for culture to develop quickly because they were more settled and situated. But those who migrated to other areas there tend to be a possibility even of decline. You know, we've lost what we used to have because we're... this is a partial answer on the top of page 4 to Jim's question. This is a partial answer where you've got this bar chart and you see the length of time that different ones live. What it doesn't show is them staggered, right? And that's in another chart that's not in here, but we do have it available. And I just think through culturally, what does it mean when you start having people, or you have people who are living centuries? You see an average commonly of 9 centuries. What does that do culturally? Yeah.
Well, it shows that Adam was able to pass on a lot of information to the generations that followed him.
Okay.
I mean, you're always giving more and more information, and people are growing from that information.
Yeah. In other words, what happens now is we'll have some generation overlap, but it's fairly minimal. Crystal?
There would be more continuity and unity of tradition and culture and ability to organize.
Yeah, and the ability to pass things along and contact. Like, you know, I would sit down and talk at length with my grandfather, who lived to like age 97, right? And so he and I would have lots and lots of conversations. And imagine talking to somebody who's been around 500 years. Whoa. And let's think about something else. How long, roughly speaking, are women in our time and culture able to have babies?
About
20
years.
Well, until their
50s.
I mean, honestly.
A few decades is probably a fair summary. Some shorter, some longer, right? But a few decades. Can you imagine if you got babies for a few centuries? What's that going to change? That's going to radically change how things happen, right? And it's going to change your perspective on subsequent generations and whatnot. I happen to have been able to have a fair amount of, you know, by going through records and, you know, hearing my grandparents tell stories and things like that, I have a fair amount of information about my great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents, even an autobiography and Civil War stories and a covered wagon chest and things like that. But I can go back, you know, maybe a couple generations and have lots of contact information, but that's kind of unusual. Not everybody can do that. Imagine if you could have some kind of personal continuity for centuries. You know, how many of us have talked to our personally to our great 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 grandfather? Right? Not too often. Yes.
I'm just kind of chuckling. My dad had two aunts and an uncle who were both younger than him.
Yeah.
His mom was the oldest child.
Yes.
And my continued natural.
Yeah.
And we've always thought, well, that's pretty funny. But
yeah.
Imagine here, so if Adam lived to 930 years and his son Seth lived to 912 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you would have cousins and siblings, yeah, and what we would consider generational.
Yeah, I'd like you to meet my third cousin 10 times removed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really would be substantial.
My first cousin,
we
just happened to be 500 years apart.
Yeah. Yeah. Stan?
But it's also the fact that Adam's around. I mean, it's cool listening to older generations talk about their stories of their life.
Right.
Can you imagine the story that Adam had to tell?
Mm-hmm.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think it brings out a good point that if a person doesn't understand the length of ages that people had, they won't understand that the information was very clear about what God had promised. And so there was no missing it. I mean, just in my life, you know, I have a personal attachment to what my great-great-grandfather has done and how it's gotten us here, and I didn't,
mm-hmm,
know. So just that you would have that many hundreds of years,
mm-hmm,
those who would want to follow God would not be missing out on any information, because the Adam and Seth, or these people would have said,
mm-hmm,
here's your information.
Yes.
So that they got off track is pretty astounding.
Let's take a look at page 5, and I'm looking at the slide that's titled Making a Covenant. And this is another one that's very significant throughout the Bible. It's very significant throughout the Bible, and it's an example of where we look to the Bible to gather our historical and cultural information. In the time of the patriarchs, human covenants had three common elements: an oath, okay, I swear, right, and swearing by a deity. So that's why you'll sometimes have God saying, I swear by myself. Right? Okay? Swearing by a deity and a physical gesture or sign, which could vary over time. Right? The physical gesture might be, we have a meal together. The physical gesture might be, I put my hand under your thigh while I make this oath. Right? And it might be a sacrifice, as it was in case of, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, would be a sacrifice to confirm it. So there was the particular content, and there was swearing by a deity, and then there was a gesture of some kind. So here comes Jesus. The new covenant was made in the Old Testament times by, and it's written by Isaiah, by Ezekiel, and Jeremiah. Okay? That's the content of the new covenant. It's not going to be fulfilled until the coming millennial kingdom. But it's confirmed the gesture or sign is Christ's death on the cross. So that's why Jesus would say, this is the new covenant in my blood. Okay? That is the gesture or sign God uses to ratify and signify the new covenant. See some eyes. Yes?
It's consistent with the covenant that God made with Abraham. He made a covenant with Abraham. We're still in a time where it hasn't completely been wrapped up.
That's right. The covenant made with Abraham is not done. That's one reason God doesn't just say, hey, we're done, folks. This is it. It's because he made a promise to Abraham and he's going to keep it. And made subsequent promises as well. Yeah.
So, if I heard this right, you said that the new covenant, excuse me, is going to be fulfilled in the millennial kingdom, and the sign of it is the cross?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
It was one of the things accomplished on the cross, Christ's death on the cross, is the signification or ratification of the new covenant that God made with Israel. And the content of that is the quintessential passage is Jeremiah 31:31. Okay? I'll put my spirit within them and they will know the law. Okay, no rabbis, don't need a rabbi. Okay? They will know the law and be empowered by the Spirit to live it out.
You know the Ezekiel passage on
the top? Have to take a look at that.
Okay.
I think it's 38:39, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is the Valley of Dry Bones, if you want to take a look at that. That's the passage I'm talking about. And I can email you all of it. But the point being that here's a covenant. It was established under Abraham. Here's something that God does actually before that. When was there a covenant for Abraham?
Adam.
It's essentially the Edenic covenant, but it ultimately with Noah, right? Noah is the prior one who has a covenant. And so what was, there's an oath, who was making an oath? God was making an oath, and what was his oath? Wouldn't flood the earth anymore. And what was the sign?
Rainbow,
okay? Here's the sign or gesture or, something of that sort. And God swore by himself, okay? So you have the three parts of the covenant, and you see those followed through on into the New Testament. So, where do you find out about that? In the Bible. By examining the Bible itself. Alright, so
I presume in Isaiah, was it 40 and later where it talks about that, or do you remember that?
I'd have to look it up.
Okay, it'd be the second half.
Yeah, because there's about a dozen passages between Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And it's in those three books.
Okay.
Yeah. Now I say that the place it starts Jeremiah 31:31, but I'll email it to you. Okay? Well, we're out of time, okay? Before people start pressing their noses against it, well, we'll pray. Okay? Thank you, Lord, for your word. Thank you for the resources that we have available to us. We really do live in an extraordinary time, a time where understanding your word is now possible more than ever before. And we just ask that you would help us learn and to use it so that we can know you better. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.